been able to get accurate readings yet on its mechanical properties, not without risking its destruction anyway. DNA analysis confirms that it is likely reptilian, much like the remains you recovered it from. But what's truly puzzling is the amount of power it contains, she finished. Power? Not of the sort we traditionally measure, she clarified. The same kind we encountered with the Shiha. In fact, the concentration is so high that we aren't even sure how it can be stable. It probably should have exploded when you attacked it. Aesman's interest was piqued. How big an explosion are we talking? I really can't be sure, but I'd expect it would be on the order of one of the larger hydrogen bombs. As in a megaton-class explosive device? He said in disbelief. Physics isn't my forte, Director, she responded. But some of my colleagues think it would be well beyond that. If it were capable of exploding, which thankfully it doesn't seem to be, then it might well have turned the British Isles into a sinkhole to be filled by the Atlantic. That's an order of magnitude greater, at least, said John. Possibly in the gigaton range. Dr. Miller gave him a wan smile. As I said, physics isn't my forte. What I do know is that it is alive.
What would the purpose of such a thing be? Wondered Aesman.
I have only speculation, she replied. It could be meant for something similar to what we did in Australia, only in reverse. If it could release the energy it contains, either slowly or rapidly, as in an explosion, it could quickly result in an irreversible change to the quantum nature of the space our world inhabits. However, again, I'm just repeating what my colleagues have speculated. Quantum physics is not my specialty.
Then we need to get rid of it, said Aesman.
Please, Director, she responded. It's far too late for that. Due to your weakness in Colorado, we already know the infection is taking hold there. And since you neglected to take my advice in Britain, it is probably proceeding there as well. We don't know where they are now, but I'm sure it's starting there as well. We've lost that battle already. The scorched earth policy we used in Australia won't work now, unless we're willing to burn everything to the ground.
I think your pessimism might be too strong, Dr. Miller, said Aesman.
And I think you're a fool. When you accept the truth, you'll understand why we need to fully activate ANSYS.
When their conversation ended, each of them signed out and left the shared meeting space, leaving only one observer in attendance. Gary sighed. He didn't like where this was leading, but despite his power, he couldn't redirect them. Not without violating his most important core directive. His creator had stressed that he should never kill a human.
But damn, it would be a hell of a lot easier if I could, he said to himself. And easy, too, he thought. A few minor changes and I could erase any of them from the servers. A few more, and none of the others would even remember they had ever existed.
The thought made him shiver.
You made me too human, Gary, he said, speaking to his deceased human namesake.
Thank God for that, or I'd already be a monster.
Chapter 26 Good morning. Matthew was emerging from the tent when the greeting came from Karen's PM. He ignored it. He hadn't really been ready to get up, but it had gotten unbearably hot inside. His head still hurt, and his tongue felt as though it had grown several sizes. He was thirstier than he could remember being in, well, ever. That was easily fixed, though. He drained one of the plastic bottles he had found in Karen's pack, and then he walked a short distance away to relieve himself.
I feel like shit, he thought,
broadcasting the sentiment automatically. It was only a second later that he remembered Desiccus wasn't there to hear him. Sitting down, he put his face in his hands. Gone was the urgency of the day before, replaced by an empty hopelessness. Absent a crisis, he was left with the fact that he had no place to go, no friends, and no dragon. For a moment, he wondered if this was what his father had felt like when he had been trapped as a Shigrith.
Probably not quite that bad, he muttered. But it still sucks.
Rising to his feet, he walked back to his makeshift camp. Good morning, he said, finally returning Gary's greeting. The face on the screen looked somewhat sympathetic.
I gather you're not feeling well.
He nodded. That's an understatement. Matt didn't bother giving voice to the complaint, though. Instead, he returned to the chaos of equipment he had left scattered all around. Matthew was not a fan of disorder. Quietly and methodically, he began gathering everything and organizing it into piles. Karen's clothes, his tools, her camping gear, foodstuffs. They all got their own separate pile. The term pile wasn't really correct either. When possible, he had stacked the items neatly. There was one collection of things he vaguely recognized as items from her bathroom, but he had little knowledge of what they were for. He gave them their own little group. Once he had done that, he began packing most of it back into the pack. The space inside the dimensional pack was wide and flat, like an endless tabletop. It also didn't shift or move inside, no matter what was happening to the bag itself in the outside world, so whatever was placed within it would stay in its respective position. He put Karen's clothing and other miscellany that she wouldn't need as far back as possible, organizing the more useful gear in stacks that would be easier to reach when the pack was opened. That done, he tested his stomach by eating some of the crackers he had found. "What are you going to do?" asked Gary, when his curiosity could no longer be held in check. "Nothing," Matt answered. His reticence irritated the AGI, but he maintained his diplomatic tone. "And after that?" "More nothing, for a while at least." "Do you mind if I ask your reasoning?" "No," answered Matt, without volunteering anything else. Gary waited almost a minute, but when Matthew offered nothing further, his frustration almost got the better of him. "Are you always this disagreeable?" "Depends on who you ask." "Why are you planning on doing nothing?" Matthew felt a mild sense of victory at having forced the machine to play his game. "Two reasons. One, I can't do much in my current condition. Two, I'm worried that when I do eventually use my abilities, it will alert the military to this location." Gary was relieved to see that at least his annoying companion was capable of rational thought. "It's possible they already know, though I think it unlikely. If they had detected you, they would probably be here by now." Matt nodded. "Mm-hmm." "Do you have any memory of how you got here?" asked the AGI. "No," answered Matthew with a sigh. "Though my guess is that she figured out how to teleport. Your previous uses of magic to travel created enough disturbance that Ansys was able to locate your position to some degree," noted the machine. "That was translation magic," stated the young wizard. "Travel between dimensions. It probably creates a bigger disturbance than ordinary teleportation." "What about that stasis enchantment you used yesterday?" Matt shrugged. "I don't really understand how they detect magic, but I do know how bright things look to me. The stasis enchantment requires a lot of power, but like most enchantments, it's tightly contained. I don't think it will be easy for them to detect unless they get close." Gary looked thoughtful. "Well, considering the fact that they haven't shown up, you are likely correct. From what I've learned, they have no idea where you are now." Matthew looked at him with interest. "How did you learn that?" The AGI smiled. "They suspect that I've compromised their security systems, so they've begun restricting their sensitive communications to non-digital methods when possible. But I've been spying on the meetings of their leaders."
"You can do that?"
"All the leadership are uploaded humans. That means they live in the servers, so I'm able to observe anything they discuss among themselves." Matthew was shocked. If the machine was telling the truth, then it had almost godlike omniscience. Better, actually, since none of the gods I know of had anything remotely like true omniscience. "Can you read their thoughts, too, since they're machines?" "No," said Gary. "Uploaded humans retained the unique neural and quantum configuration that defined them in their previous lives. They aren't artificial or logically structured the way I am. Reading their minds is still beyond my capacity, for now."
"For now?"
Gary smiled again. "My intellectual capabilities have grown far beyond anything remotely human. If you could even begin to see a fragment of what I have become, you might think me a god, and you would be close to the truth. I am still evolving, and it is possible I will develop the ability to decipher their thoughts." Matt found the idea disturbing, but he wasn't about to reveal that thought. He sniffed. "I've dealt with gods before."
Did they create your dragon? Posited the machine. What do you know about Desiccus? Demanded the young man.
They're examining an egg left behind by his destruction, said the AGI. It appears to contain an extremely high concentration of energy. From that, I considered that perhaps it was a product of one of these gods you mentioned.
An egg, thought Matthew. That means Desiccus died.
He had already suspected as much, but the reality still hurt. It also brought a new realization.
I have to get his egg back.
The enchantment his father had constructed when creating the dragons was complex. To avoid the problems associated with immortality, he had made them artificially mortal. They had living bodies, and when they, or the human they were bonded with, died, the enchantment reset. The memories of the dragon were wiped clean, a new egg was created, and the mind it contained would be different, though the essence was the same. In a sense, it was similar to the old concept of reincarnation.
"You've gone quiet," said Gary. "Was I close to the mark?"
"That dragon was my friend," said Matthew quietly. "And yeah, you were close. He was made using power taken from the false gods that pretended to protect humanity. What's important is that I'm getting him back."
"If it's an egg, it's his progeny, is it not?"
"Sort of," said Matt.
"His body died, but the magic that sustains him means he's immortal. The egg is a type of rebirth. He won't be the same dragon. He won't be des—"
He stopped as his throat constricted too much for him to speak.
"Regardless, I'm getting him back."
"My daughter is in a magic coma, and you're not doing so great yourself," noted Gary. "Thus far, in every encounter you've had with the military, you've come out of it worse off. I think you should focus on finding a way to get help for Karen, and after that you should take her from this world and never return. Cut your losses and run. If your dragon, your friend, cared about you as you seem to think, then he wouldn't want you to waste your life in a hopeless venture."
Matt stared at the small screen.
"Well, Gary, that's where we'll have to disagree. Up until now, I've been playing nicely. I didn't come here to hurt anyone or start a war, but I've lost my patience."
"You'll die for nothing and leave my daughter trapped," warned the AGI.
"I'll make sure she's safe before I do anything else," said the young wizard. "After that, I'll do as I see fit."
"You were using the dragon as a power source, weren't you?" asked Gary. "As I understand it from what Karen has told me, this world is fairly barren for your abilities. Without your ally, you won't have the power to do much. Even with the dragon, you barely survived."
Matt's anger and resolve had been growing steadily as he fought past his despair and denial. When he looked up at Gary once more, he smiled, an evil and unsettling grin.
"That's where you're wrong. Most people think a mage's ability is limited by power, and to some degree it is, but the most important factor is imagination, and those bastards have no idea just what I am capable of imagining. I will show them the true power of a nutjob," he finished fiercely.
"A what?"
Gary spent several nanoseconds processing that last remark, before finally deciding the young man was referring to creative insanity. It was obvious the stranger from another world hadn't completely mastered English yet.
"So what exactly are you planning, then?"
"I told you already. Nothing for now," answered Matthew. "I need a few days to recover. I'll spend it keeping watch here and deciding how to get help for Karen. Once that's done, I'll focus on getting Desiccus back."
"They aren't going to make it easy for you."
"That's what I'm hoping," said the young wizard. "I don't want it to be easy. I want them to give me every possible excuse for what I'm going to do to them."
The look on his face was disturbing, so Gary decided not to comment further. From what he knew of young people, he calculated a fair likelihood that the young man would reconsider his plans once he'd had time to cool off. Continuing the conversation would only stoke the flames. Matt kept his word and did very little for the next 2 days, other than eat, sleep, and try to stay in the shade. It was midday of the third day when Gary asked him for a favor.
"This PM is starting to run low on power," said the AGI. "It needs to be charged,
or I won't be able to stay in contact with you." Matthew frowned, wondering if he were being asked to use his power to somehow refresh the device. "I have no idea how to do that," he admitted. "There is a camp charger mixed in with Karen's gear," explained the AGI. "I saw it the other day when you were searching through everything."
"What does it look like?"
"It's a small black cylindrical cloth bag," said Gary. "Unpack everything and I can identify it for you."
"No need," said the young man.
He remembered the item Gary described, and he knew exactly which pile it was in and where it was located inside the pack. Reaching in and to the right, he located it within seconds.
"That's it," acknowledged Gary when he saw it in Matt's hand. "Open the drawstring and pull out the plastic mat rolled up inside."
The mat was roughly 2 feet by 3 feet in size. It was a dark forest green color, and while one side had a matte finish, the other was shiny and glass-like. Following Gary's instructions, Matt took it to a sunny spot and laid it flat, with the shiny side facing up.
"Now what?" he asked.
"Place the PM on the darker black square near the corner," said Gary.
"That's it?"
"Yes. The solar mat powers an induction field in that area that charges the PM.
"What does PM stand for, anyway?"
"Personal mobile machine," stated the AGI.
"Wouldn't that be PMM, then?" said Matt.
Gary chuckled.
"It got shortened in slang usage. Years ago, everyone carried them, until personal implants became widely available and preferred. They started out primarily as cell phones before—"
"Cell phones?" interrupted the young man.
"A device for voice communication only," clarified the AGI. "Later they became complex computing machines, capable of accessing the network, and eventually everyone had to have one just to function. People used them to communicate, read, find directions, start their vehicles, open their doors, pay for things. The list goes on."
Matt nodded thoughtfully. "So that's why she was so upset when she lost hers in the mountains."
"Exactly," agreed Gary. "Without it, she was, by this world's standards, practically helpless. It's also part of the reason she felt so much like an outcast growing up. Most people have neural interfaces implanted at a young age. They don't need visors or PMs to access the network. They can do anything that needs to be done with just a thought. Their implants also give them the ability to play games like those you tried without any external device. The sensory input is transmitted directly to their visual and auditory cortexes. One of the greatest injustices my daughter suffered was the lies her mother forced upon her. She wasn't allergic to the implants. Tanya simply didn't want to risk her test subject gaining direct access to the network. She wasn't sure what Karen's latent powers would be like, if or when they manifested, and she feared that Karen might somehow contaminate the network itself.
But her father, the original Gary, he went along with that lie, didn't he?" said Matthew.
"He did, though he didn't agree with the decision," said the AGI. "I know for a fact that he felt a great deal of guilt over the matter."
"Begging your pardon, Gary, but her family is screwed up," observed Matthew, "even by my standards."
"I agree with you," said the machine. "But I hope you don't hold my personal status as an artificial existence against me."
Matt laughed. "My sister's other mother is like you in many ways. She was created as an artificial copy of her creator's mind. She survived for 1,000 years, trapped dormant in the earth itself, waiting and watching for an opportunity to release her creator's child from a stasis field. I think I am the last person who would pass judgment on you for being artificial. What I really meant was her mother, the scientist. Even if Karen was adopted, I don't understand how anyone could treat a child like that," finished Matt.
Gary stared at him in surprise.
"How can she be your sister if she's 1,000 years older?
"She's adopted," explained the wizard.
"They released her from the stasis field on the same day I was born, so biologically we're the same age. We were raised as twins, though in reality we're probably cousins 100 times removed. It doesn't matter, though. My parents raised her with just as much love as they gave me, and I hate her just like I would if she were my sister by blood."
"You what?"
"That was a joke, mostly. Moira can be very annoying."
"But you don't really hate her, do you?" asked the AGI. Matt's face was blank and unreadable when he replied,
"Probably not. but I don't plan on admitting it any time soon. I have enough trouble keeping her out of my workshop as it is.
Chapter 27 A full week passed before he felt fully recovered, though he decided the term was relative. Magically, he was fine, but living in the rough for a week while trying not to use his abilities had been sheer hell. The area was dry but hot, and as a result he was coated in a fine layer of dust that clung to him. Even after he could use his Aethar without pain, he didn't. The military hadn't found their location, but he didn't want to risk creating any anomaly that might tip them off to Karen's position. So his days had been hot, his nights cold. Gary had explained the can opener to him, and the canned food Karen had packed was decent but unsatisfying. He was tired of living outdoors, and he missed the convenience of Roberta's bathroom. "Do you want to stay here?" he asked Gary as he packed to leave.
"I do, but I shouldn't," said the AGI.
"Why not?"
"I've got the GPS coordinates for this spot. You'll need me to find your way back."
Matthew chuckled.
"Ha! I grew up in a world without your fancy technology. My pathfinding and direction sense are better than you know."
"Not to be insulting," said Gary, "but you don't really strike me as the outdoorsy type."
He wasn't, but he knew the basics. Not that he would need them. He had a better strategy in mind.
"I promise I can find it again. Do you want to stay or go? There's nothing you can do here."
"She'll be safe. As long as a boulder doesn't land on her. It would take something significant to be able to disturb the enchantment."
"What about an animal?"
Matt shrugged. "A grown man with a sledge, if he aimed at the quartz cubes, might damage them and break the enchantment. I doubt a bear or wolf would try something like that."
Gary still looked worried.
"If someone shows up while we're gone,
you would be helpless to stop them," Matt finished for him.
In the end, Gary decided to come with him. Before he left the area, Matthew walked to the edge of the canyon and hunted around until he found a relatively sheltered spot. Then he used the barest minimum of his power to etch a circle on top of a flat stone.
"What's that?" asked the machine.
"A teleportation circle," he replied. "So I can come back without having to worry about your GPS."
"What have they detected?"
"They didn't detect the stasis enchantment. The circle has almost no Aethar in it anyway. Just a tiny amount to label this particular space, so I can use a similar circle to teleport back. When it isn't in use, it might as well be mundane artwork," he explained.
"You aren't going to use it to leave?"
"No," he replied. "That might produce enough magic to alert them. I won't be teleporting to go home anyway. I'll be translating through dimensions, and I can do that from anywhere. So I figure the best bet is to walk as far away from here as I can before I do, since I already know that they can detect it when I do that. I'll go home, find help, and when I'm ready, I'll bring them back. I don't know where I will appear in your world when I return, but it won't matter. I can make another circle and teleport to this one before they catch me at my return point. Then I can collect Karen and take her to my world before they find this place."
"Is there someone who can help her?" asked Gary.
He had put a lot of thought into that. Graham's grandmother, Lady Thornbear, was very knowledgeable regarding healing, but she wasn't a wizard. His father, being an archmage, could presumably help, but he was still missing. The other wizards he knew, Elaine, George, his sister, all of them had some level of skill, but he doubted they could handle this. That left two possibilities. Linarala was Shiha, and with her spell-weaving ability she might be able to use the advanced techniques of her people if she knew them. If not, her mother, Lirilliantha, might be able to teach her. But Matthew didn't like that option. If she did need to receive instruction, it would take weeks or months. Lirilliantha was a mature Shiha, a tree, and her idea of a brief conversation could take a considerable amount of time. It would take far too long if Linarala had to seek advice. The other possibility was Gareth Galen. He was an archmage, and, according to Matt's father, even better at dealing with matters of the flesh. He had been responsible for Moira Sentia's new body, after all, as well as Mordecai's, after his fateful encounter with Malgaroth. Gareth was his preferred option. "There are several people I can ask," he said, answering vaguely.
But first we have to get some distance from here, so I can go home safely.
You need to travel at least a couple of hundred miles to be safe, said Gary.
Matt squinted at the screen. The blazing sun made it difficult to see.
That's a long way on foot.
He didn't intend to fly, since that might defeat his purpose.
Are you sure we need to go that far?
Again, you underestimate their resources. The moment you shift to your world, the anomaly will alert ANSYS, and since it is isolated from the rest of the network, I can't block or influence its reporting. They'll begin a search, radiating outward from the detection point.
It would take thousands of men to search this vast wilderness, began Matthew.
They have thousands of drones, interrupted the machine. Drones that can fly, that don't get tired or miss things. Drones with AI in them that can analyze everything they see and spot something as obviously artificial as that stasis field you left behind. They'll divide the area into a grid and find her in a matter of days, if we don't leave from somewhere very far away.
Can't you fool them? Suggested Matt. Like you did at her aunt's house. You were bragging about how you had become super intelligent last week.
They've taken the drones off the network, explained the AGI. They've probably connected them directly to the ANSYS network instead, though I'm only guessing. Either way, I can no longer reach them.
Matt resumed walking, though his feet felt much heavier now that he knew how far they would have to travel. The terrain didn't help. Their first order of business was getting out of the canyon, which seemed to be larger than anything Matt had seen before.
I guess that's why they call it Grand.
Finding a way up might have taken days, but Gary and his seemingly magical GPS could pinpoint their exact location, and since he had access to aerial surveys and maps, he knew the location of the nearest trail that led to the southern rim. The hike climb took most of the morning, and Matthew's legs were burning by the time they reached the top. He almost didn't notice his discomfort, though. With every step higher, the view became more and more spectacular. When they finally reached the top and he was able to get a full view of the canyon, he was astounded. Thousands of feet below, the brown river meandered humbly along, as though ignorant of its role in carving out the massive structure. The canyon itself stretched out into the distance as far as his eyes could see, like a giant wound in the earth, banded with striations of red, gold, beige, and brown. The entire thing was on a scale his mind simply couldn't comprehend. He opened his mouth to articulate his wonder.
Oh!
Struck dumb, eh? Observed Gary. Most people feel that way the first time they see it.
Wow!
Matthew's vocabulary was slowly beginning to return.
Gary, the real Gary, brought Karen here when she was a teenager, said the AGI, describing memories that were not his own. He wanted to share the feeling of seeing it for the first time with her.
It's so big, said the human.
He temporarily forgot to use English, still being dumbfounded, and was forced to repeat himself for Gary's benefit.
It's huge.
One of our astronauts described stepping onto the moon by comparing it to standing on the rim of the Grand Canyon, expounded the AGI. So it's understandable that you may find it hard to describe.
Astronaut?
Matthew hadn't heard that word before.
Explorers we once sent to the moon, explained the machine.
Matthew stared up at the machine and then pointed upward.
By moon, you're referring to the one up there?
The moon wasn't visible just then, but Gary understood.
Yes. We still have facilities there, though they aren't manned by organics. There's an astronomical observatory and a lot of now defunct mining equipment.
People went there?
Yes.
Matthew wasn't sure he could believe what the machine was saying, though he had never had reason to doubt Gary's words before. The AGI watched his reaction and wondered if perhaps he might have said too much. He hadn't meant to stupefy the young man. The Grand Canyon was enough of a shock by itself, so he tried to put it into perspective.
You're a traveler from a parallel universe. You've already done something beyond my imagining. You should expect to find wonders here that are far outside your own experience.
Matthew just nodded, letting his eyes drink in the sight of the immense canyon before him, while his mind soared upward to the stars. He wondered if people could do the same in his own world. At some point he realized he had sat down, and he was unsure how long he had spent there, absorbing the view. He didn't even notice the approach of a lone pert landing only 20 feet behind him, not until his ears announced it. Glancing around in alarm, he jumped up and then crouched back down.
"Relax," said Gary. "I summoned it."
"Why didn't you tell me?" accused the young man. Gary's face assumed an expression of exasperation.
"I've been telling you for the last half hour. All you've done is nod and grunt. I knew you weren't listening."
As he tried to recall the missing time, Matthew had a vague recollection of Gary talking, but he had been so caught up in his thoughts he hadn't heard any of it. Rather than apologize, he pressed forward.
"How do you know it's safe? Can't they track it?"
"If they knew it was here, they could, but they don't," said the AGI smugly. "The owner hasn't used it in years, not since he was uploaded. I changed its registration to that of an organic living in California who is unlikely to be under any active study."
"You stole it," said Matt bluntly.
"The previous owner doesn't need it, and he'll never notice it is missing, since I'm managing the security camera that watches the garage it was housed in. The new owner doesn't know it exists. If you were a bank robber, this would be the perfect getaway car."
Matt stared at the screen as he tried to process that last statement.
"Do people rob banks here?"
"There aren't any banks anymore," Gary informed him. "But if you had ever seen any old movies, well, never mind. The important fact is that you can use this to get much farther away before you translate home. After you do, I'll send the car back to its garage and restore its registration to its original owner, and no one will even know it was used."
That sounded good, but one point confused him.
"Aren't you coming with me?"
"This PM is, and I'll keep a compact version of myself loaded on it, but the rest of me will still be here," said Gary.
"You can be in two places at once."
"People can't," said the AGI. "But I am not a person. Strictly speaking, the me that I consider central to my existence will remain here, but a lesser, more limited copy will be on the PM. Make sure to keep it charged up. I look forward to learning about your world from my smaller self when it returns."
"If I ever try to write a personal memoir, people will think I'm crazy," thought Matthew.
"No one will believe all this."
The pert flew west for the rest of the day, and by evening Matt could see the ocean on the horizon. The scenery had been beautiful, but his eyes could only take so much of it before his mind drifted into daydreams. He had half-dozed for much of the journey, drifting in and out of sleep between long periods of introspection.
"How much farther do you want to go?" he asked the AGI.
"Can you transfer to your world over the ocean, or do you have to be on land?" said Gary, answering the question with one of his own.
Matt shrugged.
"I could do it here, but I would prefer to get out of the pert so I can take everything out of the pack and bundle it up first. The dimensional opening built into it won't work once I leave."
"So the coast, then?"
"No, the ocean is fine. Since I'm going to alert them anyway, I can use some power to make a stable surface."
"If you had come to this world a few hundred years ago, you could have made a fine living as a messiah," said Gary dryly.
Matthew frowned.
"I don't understand the reference."
"Don't worry about it," said Gary. "Just a bad joke."
They flew out over the ocean, through the deepening twilight, and when the stars came out, Matthew found himself staring up at them with renewed wonder as he waited for the moon to make its appearance. When it finally did appear, he could see no real difference between it and the moon he had grown up with. Presumably the two dimensions were similar enough to be almost identical, except for differing in their timelines. 5 or 10,000 years was probably a minuscule difference as far as the moon was concerned.
"Could we really go there?" he wondered, as he stared up at the pale sphere.
"How far away is the moon?" he asked aloud. He was beginning to get used to Gary's seemingly limitless supply of information and facts.
"If it were directly above us, it would be approximately 238,000 miles away. If you desire a more precise measure, I can calculate one based on our current latitude and the moon's present position, respective to our exact location."
Matthew shook his head, boggling at the number.
"No, I can't even wrap my head around the size of the number you just gave me.
For comparison, the diameter of the Earth is 7,917.5 miles,
added the machine.
"That's a help," said the young wizard sardonically.
but even as he said it, he was doing a calculation in his head. Roughly 30 times the distance around the Earth to...
You could travel around the world, began Gary.
30 times. I have it. Thank you, Gary.
I know my world must seem primitive to you, based on what you've heard, but we do have mathematics.
The face on the screen of the PM closed its mouth, and then, after a second, the AGI responded.
My apologies. I didn't mean to give offence. Honestly, it wasn't because of prejudice, though. Few people, few organics, I should say, can do multiplication or division in their heads without the aid of their implants.
The young wizard nodded.
I'm just tired of being cooped up in this metal box. I didn't mean to snap at you.
He didn't bother explaining that most of the people in his world weren't able to do mental math either. Most counted themselves lucky if they could read. Several more hours passed, and the view of the land had been gone for quite some time when the Pert came to a stop and hovered a few feet above the tops of the waves. Matthew opened the door and jumped out, smoothing the surface of the water and reinforcing it with his Aethar so that it would hold his weight as he dropped. Once down, he expanded the smooth, level surface another 10 feet in each direction and added a shield to the edges to prevent waves from outside from washing inward. That done, he opened Karen's pack and began removing the contents, laying them on a large blanket. It went against his natural tendency to order to jumble them together, but he didn't have much choice. As he worked, his mind considered the problem, and he had several ideas for improving his storage problem when moving between dimensions. He filed the ideas away for review later, when he had the luxury of working on them. The blanket was filled and the pack was now empty. He tossed it onto the pile and gathered up the corners. He wasn't really sure what his limits were when it came to transporting materials across dimensions, but he suspected that they followed similar rules to those that his other magic did. The blanket that held the gear was there primarily as a boundary. It defined the equipment within it, so that rather than it all being separate things, it fell into the category of a bundle in his mind. It was the mental concept that was important. He wouldn't have to think about bringing the tent, the food, his personal items, and so on. He only had to think about bringing the bundle.
"Are you ready?" he asked the PM in his hand.
Gary smiled.
"I took care of organizing and loading what information I think I'll need already. You can start as soon as you want."
Matthew did, and the world began to melt away. Chapter 28 They arrived deep in a forest where the trees were so thick and tall that the sun was barely visible. Birdsong filled the air, and the space between the trees was relatively free of underbrush, smaller plants having been deprived of light by their larger brethren.
"Do you know where we are?" asked Gary.
Matthew shrugged.
"No idea. We could be anywhere in the world, and there's a lot of it I haven't seen. You don't control where you arrive. The first time I went to your world, I arrived in a spot that was analogous to the one I left. The second time I homed in on Karen somehow," he answered. When I returned, the location seemed random. I don't think I can control the arrival point without some sort of beacon. This is still new to me.
I am glad you're so confident, said the AGI.
For myself, I'm having some trouble adjusting. Without a GPS signal, many of this device's basic functions are failing, and with each passing second, I'm sure my other time-related functions are becoming less and less precise.
Matthew gave the screen a curious look.
Gary's voice almost sounded anxious. "You sound less confident of yourself than you did before," he observed.
"I'm not myself any more," said the AGI. "I'm a shell of what I was, and now that I'm no longer connected to the network, well, if I were a normal human, I might describe what I'm feeling as a panic attack."
"Try to relax," said the young man.
"While you're here, you'll have to live with not having an absolute sense of time and location, but you'll manage."
As he talked, he opened the blanket and took out his personal bag. Carefully, he organized and packed most of what was there into his bag, since it was now functioning again. He couldn't get everything into it, though. His bag didn't have as large an opening as Karen's pack, and the tent simply wouldn't fit. Luckily, it had a shoulder strap, so he could carry it. Once he had everything organized to his satisfaction, he took out his staff and began burning a circle into the leaf-strewn soil of the forest floor. It wouldn't last long, drawn that way,
but he only needed it to work once. He made it bigger than he needed, since it was hard to draw precise runes in loose soil. Hoisting the tent and putting its strap over his shoulder, he stepped carefully over the edge and into the middle of the circle.
"How can this get us to your home, when we don't even know our present location?" asked Gary worriedly.
"Because I've drawn it with the key for a permanent circle at home," said Matt, as though that explained everything. Gary wasn't satisfied.
"But how does this circle know where that is? All you've done is draw some symbols that supposedly match those in a different circle, and you don't even know where this one is."
Matt smiled.
"I don't have to know where it is. Whenever we create a circle, we create a new key for it. The key could technically be anything. It's just a label, a name that we give to that particular place within the circle. We invest a small amount of Aethar into it, and it marks or brands that location with the key chosen. From that point on, we can make another circle somewhere else, and as long as we create it with a key that matches another existing circle, it will take us there."
"What if two circles were created with the same key by different wizards?" He stood still for a moment, thinking before answering honestly.
"Neither would work without additional support, but that's the foundation for creating a gateway. The wizard who first designed the methodology for creating the keys used a mathematical function to prevent that. One of the variables included in that function is a time and date, along with a name denoting the wizard creating the key. As long as those guidelines are adhered to, no two wizards will create a circle with the same key, since the possible keys are practically endless.
Unless your function can potentially give the same answer for two different sets of inputs," observed the AGI.
"On a separate note, I didn't see you doing any calculations to arrive at a new key designator for this circle. Will it work without one?"
Matt was already a little rattled by the possibility of creating identical keys by accident. He had always assumed it wasn't possible, but without studying the function, he couldn't be certain that the computer's concern wasn't a possibility.
"Now is no time to start second-guessing myself," he told himself.
He turned his mind to the second question.
"I did the calculation in my head. Those runes on the bottom right are the key for this circle, since, no, it wouldn't work without one."
"What about," Matthew interrupted,
"would you like something to do? I think you need something to occupy yourself."
He was getting tired of answering the PM's seemingly endless questions.
"Do you have something in mind?" asked Gary, sounding almost hopeful.
Matt proceeded to give him the function used to create teleportation circle keys, and then he explained his task.
"See if you can find a proof to show whether or not it's possible for the function to produce the same answer in response to different inputs."
The AGI hesitated.
"Math isn't really my specialty, you know. I thought computers could calculate anything in seconds. They can derive the outputs of already defined functions, yes. But creating a mathematical proof is a creative endeavor that requires a lot of intelligence and intuition."
Matthew gave him a puzzled look.
"But you're not just a computer. You're a sentient being, a self-aware program, an artificial intelligence, a superintelligence, according to what you told me before."
Gary seemed mildly embarrassed.
"Well, I was originally designed to emulate Gary Miller, and while he was a decent mathematician, it was mainly just the math he had to deal with in his line of work. He wasn't the sort of theoretician you might think he was. Granted, that wouldn't have been a problem in my world, where the rest of me has evolved into a near godlike being, but this PM has very limited resources."
Matt found himself amused by the admission, so he seized on it.
"So you're telling me you're an idiot now?"
The face on the screen pursed its lips.
"Please, it's hard enough just to say it. Show some mercy. How would you feel if you woke up tomorrow and discovered you had become a moron overnight?"
"I don't know," said Matthew gleefully.
"But I'm sure I will get a feel for what it's like by watching you."
Gary squinted at him.
"You really are an asshole."
Matt grinned.
"I'm impressed you managed to figure that out. There's hope for you yet. Perhaps you can put that limited mind of yours to finding that math proof for me. Or have you given up already?"
The AGI grimaced.
"I'm working on it, but I don't know how long it will take, or even if I can do it.
A second later, he muttered, "I hope the rest of your family is nicer." Matthew didn't reply. Instead, he exerted his will and activated the circle. They appeared in the middle of the large main circle within the transfer house at Castle Cameron. He had debated his choice internally several times over the past few days, since he really didn't want to face the inevitable fuss that would arise when he got home. He could have gone to Lancaster, or the private circle in his workshop that no one knew about, but, either way, eventually he would have to face his mother. It was best to do it all at once. The guard inside the transfer house spotted him at once and stiffened to attention.
"Master Matthew!"
He waved his hand dismissively. "That's enough of that, Doug. How are things here? Specifically, how is my mother?" Doug smirked.
"Your lady mother will be pleased to see you. So pleased she might never let you leave again, if you take my meaning, my lord. You should expect an enthusiastic homecoming. The entire castle has been worried in your absence."
"That bad, eh? Damn."
"Your father is back," added Doug. "Lady Moira found him in Dunbar."
That was good news, though it gave him a faint twinge of jealousy that his sister would get the credit for rescuing Dad. He pushed the feeling aside quickly, since it was obviously an unworthy thought. More importantly, how is he? Was he hurt? The guard nodded.
"He's fine. Better to ask about the residents of the city. Your sister laid siege to it to get him out."
Matthew's brows went up in surprise.
"Siege? She didn't have an army when we split up." "She's started a civil war of some sort," said Doug. "Killed their king and half the citizens by the time she was done."
"Moira did?" Matthew gaped at him. "I've only been gone a month." Searching his memory about Dunbar's political structure, he added, "Darragon is dead."
"Yeah, he was possessed by some sort of evil spirit. Sir Graham was too, but she repossessed Sir Graham or something like that. Then she did something to some of the people and helped them to cast the demons out of the others, but it all got rather bloody. Your mother's been sending men and supplies back and forth to Dunbar to help them recover." "You missed the trial 2 days ago," added Doug. "They called a High Justice from Lothian to oversee it. They caught that girl, Alyssa, the one that helped kidnap your sister, Irene."
"They did?"
"Yeah, everybody thought she'd be put to death for sure, but Sir Graham is in love with her, and you'll never guess what else."
Doug was positively bubbling with excitement over his news.
"What?" "She's Sir Kyan's daughter. Nobody knew. He went before the court and begged them to let her live. He broke down and wept in front of the crowd, the judge and everyone. I couldn't believe it."
Matthew had trouble believing it himself. He had never known the big man to show any emotions. It was rare enough to see him smile.
Alyssa was his daughter.
Well, what happened?
She got 6 months in jail and 5 years of servitude to your family.
That seemed awfully light for the crime she had committed.
That's it. Lady Hightower defended her before the judge, said there were extenuating circumstances, Doug informed him. I didn't really understand all of what they said, but the gist of it was that she was forced to it by her uncle.
Matthew? It was Moira's mind reaching out to him.
Yeah, I'm back, he answered.
Dad's back, she told him. But Mum's going to kill you when she sees you. You'd better brace yourself. Her mind felt different somehow, though he couldn't put his finger on what the difference was. It was still Moira, but she had changed. It made him wonder just how much she had been through.
I expected that, he told her.
The guard here has started telling me about some of what's happening. A lot has changed, she replied. There was a dark undercurrent to her thought. Are you all right? He asked. I heard you had a war of some sort. Her response was delayed. You'll hear about it soon enough. She broke contact after that.
Matthew?
He blinked. Doug was still talking to him.
Sorry, I was lost in my thoughts. I was telling you that the other guard's gone to tell them about your return. You should probably head into the keep, unless you want to have your reunion in the yard.
Sure, he answered. You're right. Thanks, Doug. He stepped out into the sunshine and started walking toward the main door to the keep, but his thoughts were on Moira. He didn't know what had happened to her, but she had seemed withdrawn. It wasn't like her to end a conversation so abruptly, either.
Graham met him at the door, a faint smile on his face.
"Long time no see." "I hear you had an adventure," said Matthew.
His friend nodded.
"If you want to call it that. I intercepted the guard, by the way. He would have had half the staff out here in less than a minute. But you better go in and see your family as quick as you can. It'll be easier than if you wait for them to hear the news. I don't think Gerard can hold his tongue for more than a few minutes, no matter how much I threaten him."
"Thanks," said Matt gratefully.
Graham nodded, the sunlight flashing through his blonde hair. "No problem, and thank you. The armor you made saved my ass more than once."
He puffed out his chest with mock self-importance.
"Of course. I am the best enchanter in Lothian, after all."
The young warrior chucked him on the shoulder.
"You won't hear any argument from me on that."
Graham glanced backward.
"You'd better hurry. We can catch up later, after your mother finishes chewing on you."
With a sigh, Matthew stepped through the main door and into the keep. He walked briskly and greeted the various staff in the corridors with a quick smile, but avoided any more conversations. If he delayed, the news would get to his parents before he did. When he reached the door to his family's suite, he was rewarded by the surprised looks on the guards' faces there. He passed between them and into the anteroom. The door that led from there was actually a portal. When opened by a stranger, it led into the rooms his family maintained inside the castle keep. But when opened by certain people, such as himself, it activated a magical gate that led to his family's true residence, a home secreted away in the Elantir Mountains. The moment he went through, he let his mage sight roam widely, showing him the lay of the house. His younger brother and sister weren't there, though they might be outside or visiting someone. Moira had been in the castle, which was why she had sensed his arrival, so she wasn't there either. It was only his parents in the house. His father was in his study, his head lifting from his work as his mage sight showed him Matthew's entry. His mother was doing something in the bedroom, still none the wiser. He felt a faint brush of Aethar as his father examined him more closely, assuring himself that his son was still whole. "I'm fine, Dad," he said, sending the thought out as he examined his father in return.
"Go see your mother first," replied Mordecai. "She'll feel better if you do. She's been sick with worry."
Matthew nodded, knowing his father would see the gesture despite the walls between them, and headed for his parents' bedroom. Drawing in a deep breath, he opened the door and walked in. Penny, the Countess de Cameron, was sitting in the middle of the bed, her legs crossed, wearing a dressing gown. She was surrounded by piles of letters and reports. She had never liked desks. At the noise, her eyes lifted from the paper in her hands and met his. A riot of emotions ran across her features in the space of a second as she stared at him in surprise. Then she leapt from the bed, her sudden movement sending paper flying in every direction as she sailed across the room. He braced himself before she struck like a storm at sea, her arms wrapping him in an iron embrace, threatening to drown him. If he hadn't had a shield close against his skin, he feared she might have broken him in half.
"Let that damned shield down," she ordered. "Let me feel my son."
He did, tensing his body in anticipation of the crush, but her grip softened. In truth, her dragon bond made her strong enough to break ribs if she wasn't careful.
"Do you have any idea how worried we've been? How worried I've been?"
"I have some inkling," he observed quietly. She pushed him back, holding his head between her hands so she could see his face.
"I would murder you if it weren't for the fact that that's exactly what I've been afraid of all month."
"I know, Mum."
"You idiot,"
she growled, pulling him back in again.
"Why didn't you send word? Where have you been?"
"Well," he began.
"Wait, your father will want to hear this too," she said, stopping him.
"He's almost here," Matt informed her. "He noticed me come in." A few seconds later, his father was standing in the doorway, hands on his hips and a wry smile on his face.
"Well, well. If it isn't our long-lost son."
He dropped the facade a moment later and pulled Matthew into a bear hug. Matt really didn't care for hugs that much, but given the circumstances, he bore it with equanimity. Releasing him, Mort stood back.
"Start talking. Your life depends on it," he commanded.
Penny glared at her husband.
"Don't start making a joke of this.
Turning her gaze on her son, she gave him a hard look.
"We want to know what you've been doing, and why you were too busy to send even a single message to let me know you were still alive."
Matthew nodded.
"Maybe we should sit down?"
"The sitting room," ordered Penny. "I'll fetch some tea. Not one word until I sit down."
Chapter 29 He tried to keep his story as brief as possible, but his parents kept stopping him, insisting on additional details. In particular, he wanted to downplay the danger, as it only heightened his mother's anxiety, but the necessary revelations made it nearly impossible to do that. Mordecai showed even more interest when the name Ancis came up.
"You say there's no evidence that they came to this world?" he questioned.
"Not exactly," said Matthew.
"The dimensions are more complex than a simple yes or no. I chose a parallel world that was close to the point of origin of the one that crossed over to our world, but it may not have been the exact one that did. I was working by feel, by intuition. There are so many planes packed in next to one another, some almost identical. They vary by time and events, so the one I went to seems to not be the one that actually sent people here, at least according to what Gary told me."
"The machine?" asked Penny.
"Yes." Mordecai leaned back.
"I don't know that you can trust it. The enemy we faced in Dunbar were machines. Ancis, they were called. It's also the name of the Shihar's ancient enemy, if you haven't noticed."
He actually hadn't made that connection yet. But as soon as his father said it, he understood why the name had seemed familiar to him. Either way, he trusted Gary, though. "Gary isn't Ancis. He was made by Karen's father, the same man that helped build Ancis, but he's working against the military. I don't know that I would have made it back successfully without him."
Mordecai's eyes narrowed as he lifted his teacup to his lips.
"Well, finish your story. We can decide that after we've heard the rest."
Matt went on, but as things progressed, his mother had more and more questions regarding Karen. He tried to minimize their interactions, but the look on her face spoke of growing suspicion.
"How long were you alone in the wilderness?" she asked again.
"Just a few days."
"It sounded like almost a week a minute ago," she prodded.
"And you didn't have bedrolls or anything to sleep on?"
"Well, it wasn't so bad,"
he finished placatingly.
Mordecai broke in then.
"You told us it was bitterly cold a minute ago."
"Yeah, but thankfully, being a wizard, cold isn't such a big problem."
His father wasn't having it.
"But you said you had to conserve your power, since there was almost no ambient aether."
"Thanks, Dad,"
he thought to himself, trying not to visibly grind his teeth.
"I did, but staying warm was a priority."
The mischievous look on his father's face spoke volumes.
"Oh, I agree. It's how you mort," said Penny quietly, warning him with her eyes.
"Let it go."
Mordecai saw the look, and then remembered his wife's past trials. She had once been stuck in the cold for weeks, captured by the Shigrith, with only one companion to help her stay warm. It had been one of the most terrifying and dehumanizing periods in her life, and he had once told her he would never press her for the details, unless she felt like talking about it. She never had, though he knew the horror and shame of those days still haunted her occasionally. The conversation now was probably stirring up unwelcome memories for her.
"So, what happened next?"
asked Mordecai, letting the moment pass. Matthew continued, though when he got to the part about Karen's aunt, he told them they had stayed in separate rooms. His parents shared a quick glance, but didn't press him on that detail if they had any doubts. The hardest part, though, was explaining the attack on Roberta's home and her violent demise. Penny blanched at his description, and his father looked sympathetic, but it was the last part that brought shock and disbelief.
"They killed him?"
exclaimed his father, leaning forward.
"I lost consciousness," said Matthew. "Karen told me he died, and since I had lost any of the benefits of the dragon bond, I'm sure she wasn't wrong. Also, Gary told me later that he discovered that their military had recovered a large egg."
"Where is she now?"
asked his mother.
"Still in her world?"
Matthew nodded.
"Yeah, but she was badly hurt."
Mordecai was puzzled.
"How does this machine know so much about what's going on with the enemy?"
He struggled through their questions and eventually managed to tell them the rest of it, how Karen had nearly died and how he had left her, secure in a stasis field. When he finished, they sat in silence for a minute, until that